Chapter 1. Iron Gates. The five of us were bundled up against the frigid winds blowing through Beijing as we unfolded ourselves from the taxi's cramped interior. We'd had our Hotel Dongfang concierge order us a cab to get us here by the start of business this morning of February 22, 1993. Heavy black iron gates of the Mongolian Embassy to the People's Republic of China loomed before us. Behind those gates and inside the embassy were the visas we needed to enter Mongolia and follow God's call on our lives. We couldn't help but notice a crowd of about 50 was encamped between us and the gates. Asking my wife, Louise, to wait at the curb with our three young daughters, I pushed through the milling collection of Chinese and Mongolians to the armed guard at the gate. I comforted myself with the idea that all these people probably had no legitimate business inside, and I would be quickly passed through. The unsmiling guard, however, failed to move aside or provide an explanation in English. I mimed I needed to speak to someone inside, and he motioned me over to an intercom. This was good progress. We'd be inside and out of the cold in just a few moments. The speaker crackled to life in response to my buzz. "Yes, how may I help you?" an accented female voice queried. I explained my family needed to get in to secure our visas for Mongolia. "That is impossible until Wednesday, sir. The embassy is closed for our Mongolian national holiday." I was stunned. We had, with some difficulty, purchased tickets to fly into Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia's capital city, the next day. We couldn't afford to stay any longer than two nights at the Hotel Dongfang, and we had no way of contacting our friends in Mongolia to tell them we would be arriving late. Stalling for time to sort out my thoughts, I blurted, "What national holiday?" She answered it was the week-long festival called Sagansar, the herdsman's New Year. I held down the talk button and quickly maintained that we couldn't wait for Wednesday, since we had non-exchangeable tickets on MIAT, the national airline. "Sir, I am sorry, but the ambassador is celebrating the holiday and will be indisposed until Wednesday. He cannot issue any visas until then." I was crushed, but I really had no alternative, so I kept begging her to make an exception. I told this lady all about my three small daughters who at 7, 4, and almost 2 years old, couldn't stand outside in this bitter cold. The girl's staccato complaints through chattering teeth in the background helped our cause. I wished I could hold them up to a security camera and show her their frost-nipped cheeks and runny noses. It worked. Asians have a wonderful soft heart toward children, and especially larger families. "Okay, go back to your hotel and telephone at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Perhaps the ambassador will be awake and able to help you then." I thanked her profusely and pushed back out through the crowd to Louise and the girls. I was praising God for this new hope, but Louise was discouraged by the news, and the exhaustion and strain of moving a family of five into the unknown was clear on her face. I knew if we just went back and twiddled our thumbs in that small hotel room until 2 o'clock, we'd all be ready for straitjackets. We had to get our minds off what we were facing. We prayed briefly and committed everything one more time to the Lord, and then caught another cab and went to Tiananmen Square to kill time. Not one sign remained of the massacre that had happened there just a few years before. We stood in the endlessly shuffling line to visit Mao's preserved corpse in his huge mausoleum. There were constant warnings to be quiet and respectful. There was a very religious reverence, both encouraged by the guards and observed by the thousands visiting. We were so nervous about the girls blurting something out, grabbing a flower, or goodness knows what. As we exited into the cold yet refreshing outside air, Melody said loudly, "That was just a dead guy." We beat a hasty retreat from the shrine to the founder of Chinese communism. Still, her 7-year-old wisdom was a graphic reminder of the risen Christ's superiority over the gods of men and their governments. Back in our hotel room, when 2 o'clock finally came, I called the Mongolian embassy and the same woman told me to call again in an hour. We decided I should go again in person and wait at the embassy while Louise stayed behind with the girls and covered me in prayer. A crowd of about 20 was milling around at the gates when I arrived. I quickly determined we were all in the same boat. There was another American there who spoke Mandarin Chinese. He was an elderly missionary trying to transit through Mongolia to teach in Siberia. He had actually been brought up in China by missionary parents before the Communist Revolution expelled them. My new friend explained everyone had been told to wait in case the ambassador could be sobered up enough to grant visas. He had been busy observing Sagansar's custom of getting drunk on vodka and gorging on meat dumplings and staying that way for an entire week. Someone within had divulged that he was apparently just short of comatose from last night's revels, and the staff had been unable to rouse him. As we waited, stomping around to prevent losing toes to frostbite, we experienced some strange crowd dynamics. A rumor would shoot through the growing group at the gates that the back gate was open and admitting people. Suddenly, like migrating wildebeests, without any discussion, all of us would go tearing around the large compound's perimeter. We'd arrive at the back gate, only to find it closed and guarded as the front gate. We'd sheepishly wander back around to the front of the embassy until another rumor would start us off again. Every once in a while, a car would go in or out, and the guard would hold us all back. His hand on his gun dispelled any thoughts of a run on the embassy. After about an hour of this, it hit me that the physical reality of having the gates of Mongolia, represented by the embassy, closed against me was a picture of the same thing happening spiritually. I began to pray loudly and worship fiercely against those gates, actually laying my hands on the iron gates and commanding them to open for the ambassador of the King of Kings and Khan of Khans. I sang out loud, "Jesus Christ is Lord of Mongolia." My missionary friend moved away to the other side of the crowd, convinced the strain had finally unhinged me. Mongolians and Chinese gave me extra room and gazed on me in stunned amazement. Even the guard did nothing as I walked past him and grabbed the gates. They all thought I was a lunatic. I felt God in what I was doing, so I continued, telling him silently, if he didn't move to open the gates, I'd die of embarrassment. Either way, my problem would be solved. After about 5 minutes of verbal prayer warfare and worship that seemed like 50, I abruptly ran out of things to say. I just sputtered to a stop. At least 30 pairs of eyes were drilling into my back as I faced that gate. I was afraid to even look in the guard's direction. God, now what? I can't just stand here. I had an urge to call inside on the intercom. Without asking the stunned guard, who was right next to it, I walked over and punched the buzzer. A male voice answered, "What?" "This is Mr. Hogan. I was instructed to return at 2 o'clock to see the ambassador. It is now 3:30. You need to open this gate and let me in," I said with sudden confidence. 5 minutes?" he sputtered in reply. I could see his face in the window across the courtyard. I held up my wrist and pointed to my watch. 5 minutes," I repeated firmly. I saw him nod. Exactly 5 minutes later, to the amazement of all those waiting, myself included, the gates swung open. You could have knocked the whole crowd over with a feather. Not one of us had been allowed inside that whole day. I marched across the courtyard, conscious of the envious stares following me in, and entered the building. After hanging up my coat, I found myself in an elegant sitting room with 2 French diplomats and an American petrochemical executive. It turned out they were more comfortably engaged in the same thing the people outside were doing, waiting for the possible appearance of the ambassador. They had been informed when and if the staff could rouse him, we might be able to see him. To marshal more prayer, I called Louise at the hotel, filled her in, and then waited. After about a half hour, I started worrying about my more conservative missionary brother outside in the wind whipping across from Siberia. I went over to the Mongolian manning the desk who had buzzed me in. "Do you see that old man out there?" I asked. He nodded. "Well, he is an American who was born in China many years ago. He has spent his life helping Asian people. If he becomes ill from this cold and dies, I think it will be a huge shame on your country for leaving this good and frail man outside." "Please tell him to come inside," he exclaimed with real concern, and he hit the gate opener while I ran out front and waved him past the guard. He gratefully joined the little VIP group waiting inside. At 6 o'clock, after 2.5 hours' wait inside the embassy, the ambassador of Mongolia appeared through a doorway, supported by two friends equally hungover and pained. He took his seat at the desk vacated by the intercom guy. Our group quickly lined up to meet him. "Gentlemen, I am not feeling well and my head hurts from too much," he rasped, clicking his forefinger against his throat in what was clearly sign language for drinking. He managed a smile both sly and wry. "You will please present your documents, invitation, and return airline tickets. I will issue you visas if all is in order. And please, talk quietly." His friends left the room. I noticed a boy of about 10, whom I assumed was his son, standing beside the ambassador. This kid was doing all the stamping and the passports for his father. I noticed everyone except me had availed themselves of the visa application form stacked just out of eyeshot from the chair I had just vacated. I got out of the short line and frantically began filling in the 5 forms we needed, juggling passports and transcribing numbers, dates, flight info, and remembering everyone's birth date was keeping me busy, but not too busy to realize I was in trouble. I had the passports and sufficient dollars for the visas, but I had neither return tickets nor letter of invitation or contract to work in Mongolia. I could hear him asking the older missionary to produce each of these items, and that just to transit through the country. "Oh, God," I breathed, "you haven't done all this and opened those gates out there just to have this man send us back. Please get me through this." I finished scribbling out the forms just as the line dwindled to only one in front of me. Soon, I was the last one. I was still struggling to rubber cement the correct photo on each application when the ambassador wearily reached for my paperwork. As he scanned our applications, I was praying hard that he would not ask me to see our return tickets or proof of a Mongolian hosting organization, as he had just requested everyone else before me. By some miracle, he didn't ask me to produce any tickets at all. He only wanted to know who was inviting us into Mongolia. The truth was, I didn't have any clear idea of this myself. My only hope was that two very young Mongolian entrepreneurs I had been in contact with had actually been able to come up with something since we had left home. Alder and Batjargal, who'd made a business out of helping missionaries, had been telexed instructions to fax the embassy with the details of any contract they could manage to arrange for us. We had never received any response, and indeed, we doubted our telex had even reached them. The last contact we'd had with them had not been promising. With sudden inspiration, I replied, rather louder than he preferred, "It's written on our letter of invitation. They telexed you. Why don't you get the telex and we can both look at it?" Strictly speaking, this was a possibility. If any contract for us to work in Mongolia was in existence, it was certainly here somewhere. I prayed he wouldn't even look. The ambassador shot me a disgusted look and said in a raspy voice, "That will not be necessary." He passed the 5 open passports to his boy, and our blue Mongolian visas were stamped inside at 6:45 p.m. We flew out for Mongolia early the next morning. God had been true to his word to us. The door of steel, the iron embassy gates we'd encountered, proved to be only tinfoil as we burst through. As exhilarating as these miracles were, Louise and I were both hoping we'd faced our last barrier of this kind.